We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
Joining me today is Professor Stephen Zunis. He is the chair of the Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. And I want to talk about Syria and the Islamic State, although I don't really like that name because it doesn't appear to be either one, Islamic or a state. But Obama claims he's bombing them, although on the ground it looks like he's just bombing Syrian infrastructure. And yet, on the other side of the aisle, you have McCain and some of the other lunatic senators who still want Assad to be the prime target. But I guess before making sense of that, let me ask if you agree with that ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda 2.0, whatever, is not really a state or Islamic.
Well, it's certainly not Islamic. I mean, even though they call themselves a caliphate, if you look at the history of caliphates from the time of Muhammad through the Ottoman Empire, while non-Muslims are never treated as equals, they generally respected the autonomy and the rights of minorities. They even allowed them to have their own distinct judicial systems and the like. And so this kind of intense tolerance the so-called Islamic State has towards minorities is very different than what we've seen historically, as well as their just incredible totalitarian ways of ruling and interpreting Islam, where even devout Sunni Muslims can find their heads chopped off if they disapprove with the ISIL leadership's interpretation. In terms of a state, they do control major roads and urban areas and parts of northwestern Iraq and northeastern Syria.
That's still more of an army than a state.
Yeah, very, very much so. They're trying to put up some kind of infrastructure. But they refuse to recognize the arbitrarily drawn colonial boundaries. But it's they are essentially a rebel army that controls a swath of territory. Again, not what most people would constitute a state. Obviously, no country recognizes them as such.
It's more of a power grab with a theme.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they do have a cult, I guess it's fair to say.
Oh yeah, very, very, very much so. In many ways, they parallel the Lord Resistance Army. The Kony Group. Which has been terrorizing parts of Uganda and other areas in East Africa. They claim themselves to be a Christian organization. They're in the very name, Lord's Resistance Army. Anybody can expropriate the name of a religion and put their own perverse twist on it. Aung San Rikyo, the cult in Japan. That was responsible for those nerve gas attacks some years ago and other things.
Shoko Asahara.
Yeah, they grew out of the Shinto tradition. I mean, these things.
Oh, no, that was actually a quasi-Christian cult.
Right, you're right, I'm sorry.
The press said it was Shinto and Buddhist even, but he was all this is splitting hairs, but he was all pulling things from the Book of Revelations and called himself the Christ and thought there was going to be an Armageddon. So.
My point being is that any cult can take advantage of this sort of things for their own benefit, and just the idea of they're somehow a representative of a particular religious tradition or somehow an inevitable outgrowth of that tradition is I think it's pretty ignorant.
But I think it does need to be pointed out, because when you brought up the example of, say, Kony and or Charles Taylor or somebody like that, and saying, well, they call themselves a Christian group, people in the United States, who a majority of them are Christian, kind of can clearly see that and say, no, you're not. Mm-hmm. But Islam's a lot less, it's unfamiliar. And so there are a lot of, Fox News bobbleheads that say, yeah, that's what Muslims do. I mean, they're bad kind of Muslims, but they're still Muslims, and they really think it's a natural part of the theological philosophy or something.
That's frankly the same kind of Islamophobia we've seen that has been used to, justify imperialist intervention since the time of the Crusades.
Yeah, it's sad. It's lasted that long. Okay, well, that's out of the way. So they're not really a state, but they do control a lot of territory, like a military occupation, and they're just sort of a power grab of the theme, not anything authentic to a religion, any religion. But so to make a clearer picture of the sectarian factions in Syria, because there's a lot more than just ISIS and the FSA, sort of a number of different groups, and then, of course, there's the government itself. I think it might be a good idea to rewind back to Iraq in 2003 with that invasion, because we saw a orientalization there, sort of like the partition of Pakistan, where I don't think these religious groups really have a great theological divide.
No, not at all.
And they were getting along. I mean, they weren't murdering each other anyway before.
No, not at all. I mean, theologically, the differences between Sunnis and Shias is actually less than that between Catholics and Protestants.
But they fought each other too.
Yeah. But it's
it was just as stupid.
Yeah. But generally, in modern times, they generally only fought each other when they paralleled certain nationalists or other identities. We saw that in Northern Ireland. For example, the Ulster Unionist groups and the Irish Republican Army weren't killing each other, killing each other's people because of, they were theological differences.
You have a pope and we don't, or something.
And it was about how, for various historical reasons, the Protestants identified with Great Britain and the Catholics identified with the Irish Republic. And similarly, the divisions in Iraq are not really about religion, at least they weren't initially. But the what happened was when the prior to the U.S. invasion, intermarriage was fairly common. If there was one mosque in a small town, Sunnis and Shias worshiped together, it was no big deal. What shifted was when the United States overthrew a brutal but secular leader under Saddam Hussein. Shias were in prominent positions in the Ba'ath Party and in government. His vice president, foreign minister, was Christian.
Now, is it true that Saddam himself was even helped by the U.S. to take power to
initially,
put
initially in,
against
the
communists?
In the late 80s, some other Ba'athists were seen as a little more pro-Soviet, and whereas Saddam was less so. But when he was ousted, the United States ended up embarking kind of a divide and rule to kind of weaken the central government to dominate the country more. I don't think the U.S. had an idea how far things would go out of control. But what ended up happening was the U.S. Ended up abolishing the two main bastions of secular nationalism in the country. The first was the Iraqi army, which was, of course, predated Saddam Hussein. And, well, obviously, some of the top leaders who were war criminals needed to be ousted and brought to justice. The entire armed forces was abolished. And it was replaced by the sectarian militia, primarily the Badr Corps, which was the militia of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was recognized by Iran as the government in exile. And when Saddam was in power, the Badr Corps is actually largely formed and trained and armed by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They even fought on Iran's side during the Iran-Iraq War. Uh-huh. So along with the militia affiliated with the Dawa and other Shia groups, many Sunnis in the country saw their historic enemy, the Persians, as a result of intervention by their other historic enemies, U.S. and Britain, as Western imperialists.
The extremists blame
the Shias collectively for what happened, and so some of the extremists started killing random Shias, and then the Shia-led government started killing random Sunnis. and things ended up spiraling out of control from there. So again, it was like the same reason Protestant pubs and Catholic pubs were blown up, you know, by the other side. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of collective guilt of one side or the other. And then I should mention the second message of secular nationalism. That was the civil service. The United States decreed that if you were a member of the Ba'ath Party, you could not have any position in government. But like a lot of authoritarian states, you essentially had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party to have any government position beyond a certain level. So you, whether you agreed with the government or the Ba'ath Party or not. And so the government ministries, which again were diverse, representing all parts of the country, where became basically these fiefdoms for these Shiite sectarian parties. And so basically the Sunnis ended up being alienated. And that is really what led, you know, to the so-called sectarian conflict we saw in Iraq, which ISIS has been able to take advantage of.
It only takes one collectivist to create more. Because once you have one group that identifies itself as a whatever, and they start attacking people, then regardless of how it begins, they get caught in a kind of cycle of revenge killing. They killed some of us, we killed some of them, and it just expands and expands. And then what you're saying on top of that is you have this, if I get this right, like factional nepotism, where Shiites are in control of government and they divvy out the money and the jobs and resources and stuff only for their brand, and isolate and alienate everyone else. And so they start to say, well, because we hear it just like common knowledge in the U.S., well, that's a Shia government or that's a Sunni government, as if their theological thinking and their political beliefs just are naturally the same. To me, that's always seemed a little crazy, how you can have an entire political body that all also believes the same religion. I mean,
yeah, right. It's weird. It is, and basically, so just to kind of continue with the chronology, when the Sunnis and the were rising up against the U.S. occupation and the Baghdad government, among them, and there were at least 40 or more factions fighting the U.S. and Baghdad, Al-Qaeda in Iraq emerged. They are so extreme and horrendous that most of the Sunni tribal leaders basically felt that Al Qaeda was actually a bigger threat than Baghdad, and so they made a deal that they would switch sides and fight Al Qaeda if the government would allow Sunnis better representation in government ministries, in the armed forces, etc. The government agreed. And the Sunnis tribesmen were able to defeat Al-Qaeda. And that was what defeated Al-Qaeda, not the surge. I mean, it's ironic that you have these Republicans saying, oh, it was a surge that ended that stopped the bloodshed. No, it was this deal that the Sunni tribesmen had made. But Baghdad ended up not coming through on its end of the bargain. The discrimination continued and even worsened when Sunnis protested, mostly nonviolently, including these long-term sit-ins. Hundreds were massacred. Dissident intellectuals, journalists, activists, leaders were jailed, tortured, assassinated. And so when this latest manifestation of Salafic Sunni extremism, ISIL, came in, the Sunnis did not fight to defend the government. They essentially let them walk in. The government forces basically threw down their guns and ran. And in very short order, ISIL ended up controlling the major cities of northern and western Iraq. And they captured an enormous amount of equipment, American-made equipment. And that has strengthened their ongoing fight in Syria against the Assad regime.
Yeah, why would the Sunnis fight against them a second time when they already got shafted by the Shia government? And so they're not, why would they defend them again? But still, they had to flee their territory, it seems. But so back to Syria, we have the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, whatever. But they're not the only group that's cutting off heads and things. The U.S. and the Saudi Arabians have been backing al-Nusra and several other factions and have been for years. And they've been grilling heads and cutting heads off and things. And so, What is the, I mean, you and I already know this, but how do they explain this to the public that it's wrong when one group cuts off a head, but when the other groups are doing the same thing, attacking children and everything else, that's not a humanitarian crisis or anything. It's only when ISIS does it. Why is al-Nusra, why is it in U.S. interest, not Israeli interest or anybody, in American interest, to back these guys against Assad? Commercial time. We'll be right back to the podcast after this brief message from our sole sponsor, SkinSpa.com. SkinSpa.com has an amazing selection of premier European natural and organic skin and body care products, as well as aromatherapy, cosmetics, and much more. They offer free skincare consultation with a licensed esthetician and free samples with every purchase. Pamper yourself or someone you love with a great gift. Mention the coupon ANC and save 10% on your order. Bring the spa home at skinspa.com. That's www.skin-spa.com. And I want to add my two cents that I appreciate this company's support, and I do enjoy supporting them because this is an American-owned family business, and we should always support our small businesses. There's gear on there for men and women. Go check it out. At least go have a look. Skinspa.com, you can see the banner on the bottom right side near the Eddie Bravo LA trip fundraising that's going to happen. And I do have a quick announcement about that, and I'll wait till the end of the podcast. Now back to the show. And yet, when ISIS does it, it's bad.
Well, actually, the U.S. has not been backing on this either. We've been, the backing, which has been fairly limited. Until,
well, not overtly, recently
has been with what they call the Free Syrian Army. But the problem is the Free Syrian Army consists of literally hundreds of separate militia, which are not under central command. And, you know, when you send arms to people like that, it doesn't necessarily make them stronger. It generally makes, you know, means just more people getting killed. And that's why, and indeed, ISIS and al-Nusra, but ISIS in particular, has been able to overrun these FSA positions and capture their weapons. And in some cases, in the course of the struggle, these FSA factions have become more radicalized and actually have voluntarily joined in with ISIS or al-Nusra. And so, you know, that's one reason that President Obama was reluctant to get more involved than the U.S. has in terms of supporting these groups, despite enormous pressure, you know, from Republicans and from Democrats like Hillary Clinton and other hawks in his own party. But he caved. He now is going to start upping training and arms for these FSA militia. A resolution approving that passed Congress a couple weeks ago by a fairly sizable bipartisan majority.
They can't see the backstabbing coming there. I mean, how many times do you have to do it in a row? Oh, we meant for these to go to the good militants, and over and over again it doesn't. So
exactly. I mean, the vast majority of ISIL's weaponry is of U.S. manufacture, captured from the Iraqi army or groups that the U.S. was arming, or they were these were arms sent by our so-called friends in the Persian Gulf, the various Arab monarchies, much of which, in fact, did go to some of the more hardline Islamic groups.
And those allies are a bunch of head cutters too.
Yeah, really. I mean, Saudis have cut off, beheaded hundreds of people, and just in the past couple of years, and you know, they and given the nature of the judicial system there, I think it's fair to say that a good number of these people were as innocent as the journalists and aid workers whose beheadings caused so much outrage here in the West.
But again, at the root of it, why is it the U.S.'s business to topple Assad at all? Syria is not a threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, and I think again that's what's made the Obama administration reluctant to do a lot more, and
they just want to sell guns, or like what's in
I mean, I think we'd love to, if we wave a magic wand and get rid of Assad. I think the U.S. would really like that. I think there are a lot of Syrians who'd like that, actually. But the concern is what ends up taking his place. I mean, when there's a popular pro-democracy, non-violent uprising in 2011, which included all sectors of Syrian society. The Assad regime responded brutally. The uprising was largely spontaneous. It wasn't well planned. A lot of people didn't realize it was going to be a harder regime to overthrow because, unlike in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt, you know, this is not a case of one man rule. The Assad regime is a lot more than Assad. It's the Ba'ath Party is a well-established party that's ruled the country for over a half century. You had the armed forces, you had crony capitalists, you had religious minorities. In other words, they had a social base that Gaddafi and Ben Ali and Mubarak never had. And so it was going to be a long, protracted struggle. And in any case, and some people in the movement got frustrated and took up arms, including a fair number of Syrian soldiers who defected when they didn't like the idea of shooting into unarmed crowds. And so, and I think this is a terrible mistake on a whole number of levels. It just justified even greater repression by the Assad regime, but it led to the rise of these Islamic extremists who have essentially hijacked this a popular movement and ended up, of course, making a lot of people who would have, you know, happily taken part in a nonviolent democratic movement to get rid of Assad, to actually now support Assad because they see him as the lesser evil.
Yeah, he had a coalition of religious minorities too that are being persecuted. I question how all that got started with the shooting and the innocent crowd, because I saw the same thing in Kiev, and I have to retain some doubt on both accords.
Yeah, Syria is genuine. I mean, the nonviolent phase of the movement was in the very
beginning. Yeah,
in the early stages was a genuine popular movement.
Assad had been president for 10 years without all that violence, and then suddenly this one year, everybody spontaneously is having this Arab Spring thing, and I don't know how organic any of those were. I'm just skeptical of it.
Oh, no. I mean, no. I think let's not deny human agency. I mean, let's not have a mirror of the right wing who said that all these revolutions in Central America and third world countries, et cetera, were a plot hatched in Moscow. Moscow armed some of these movements and obviously, you know, wanted to take advantage of whatever changes might take place, just as the United States has sent money to opposition groups and wants to manipulate things to go in their direction as well. But you know, these were genuine popular movements.
Yeah, that's the thing. That it's hard or almost impossible for there to ever be an organic movement unless you're the superpower, because they're always going to be caught in a tug of war between someone like the US or the Soviet Union or whoever the big dog is at the time, who's going to take it over. As soon as they see any faction, like, aha, let's try and take over Cuba, let's try and take over Honduras, let's try and take over whoever, because we found a few people protesting. It gets taken over quickly by these agencies, and it becomes violent very quickly. It's just nasty to me, and I see this strange double standard, because the U.S. is always pontificating about human rights and this and that, but they're supporting the PKK and the Israelis and Jandala and Saudi Arabia and Kev and all these other crazy people.
Yeah. And PKK angle is ironic, because the U.S. Supported the Turkish government in the 1990s with hundreds of millions of dollars of aid, as they were fighting, not just fighting the PKK, but fighting the Kurdish civilians. And over 30,000 Kurdish civilians were killed during the 1990s. Hundreds of villages were wiped off the map.
97 in this was battle, the peak of that, and the peak of U.S. aid.
Yeah, exactly. And but now, you know, the PKK is suddenly seen as an ally, because, you know, they can be an effective fighting force against ISIL.
We just make Frankensteins everywhere. Your last question: do you think that some of the anti-Muslim sentiment in Europe is causing so much of the diaspora, for lack of a better word, to go and join ISIS? Or
well, in terms of total numbers, it's Very tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of
kind of overblown
of Muslims in Europe, and I think the vast majority of them are motivated because of the horror of the repression by the Assad regime. And as a result, I think this idea, oh my God, they're going over there to be trained as terrorists to come back and kill European Christians or American Christians or whatever, is grossly exaggerated. I mean, there's certainly a risk that, you know, as in Afghanistan, some people will end up being being radicalized. So you can't rule that out altogether.
I was looking at it not as fighting Assad, but now that the Americans are bombing, I'm going to go join the ISIS now because screw the U.S., you know.
No question, because the greatest likelihood that some of these extremists will end up striking the United States and Europe is if we bomb them. And indeed, the Haaretz, a leading Israeli newspaper, reported that recruitment for ISIL has grown dramatically since the bombing began. That should not be a surprise. Whatever limited tactical strategic advantages bombing may have in terms of curbing ISIL's areas of control is going to probably be more than made up by the political gains that they will get. I mean, if there's any the reason they were doing these horrific publicized beheadings and this threatening rhetoric is basically to goad the West into bombing them so they could see themselves as we are the defenders of Islam against the imperialist infidels. And I mentioned Iraq, just as Al-Qaeda in Iraq was defeated by the Sunni tribesmen in areas they controlled rising up against them. This is really the only way to defeat ISIL, is if the Sunnis in Syria and Iraq rise up against them, and some of them already have, but they're being hurt by this bombing, because the bombing of the cities by Western governments and the use of a Shiite militia and Kurds and everything like that just strengthen the kind of nationalist fervor that ISIL can take advantage of and get them more support, you know, from within the areas they can control. And so, again, this is, I mean, even putting aside the moral and legal arguments,
well, the bombs are killing
bombing
civilians
is really
too.
Stupid. It's really stupid, and it's going to end up strengthening them.
It's killing civilians, too, in that if you kill 8 civilians, you just put 8 different families completely against you forever. And in Iraq, you have a whole generation of kids. I mean, they're in their 20s, but, you know, they grew up basically not knowing anything else. And so, but the one thing they do know is enemy number uno is the United States. That's who blew up all their infrastructure and starved them to death between the two wars, about 500,000 people there. So that's the greater enemy. And if, whoever they see as kind of saber rattling and sticking it to the man that way, that's who they're going to side with. Not everyone's going to be that deep and analytical into politics. I mean, a lot of them don't even have access to a lot of the things and advantages that we have, and they're just seeing ISIS as the ones fighting America, and so we couldn't recruit for them faster.
Exactly.
I mean, it's never worked in the past, bombing stuff. It just doesn't work. You break everything. Well, I appreciate you and your time, and I think you have a very good analysis on this, and I look forward to reading your pieces, and keep sending me those on the emails there. I read them all. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice talking with you.
You know a lot of stuff. The last time you were on, we were talking about Mali, I think, and now Syria. So keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye bye. That was Professor Stephen Zunes. Google his name. It looks like Zunes, Zunes. Stefan, it looks like Stefan Zunes. And he is in publications all over the place, Huffington Post, The Progressive, etc. Now, I have an announcement about the trip to Los Angeles. I have several agendas going on now. I'm going to be explaining 9/11 on the Eddie Bravo radio show, which is very exciting. A lot of it is going to be the info that is in my film, War by Deception. But, of course, I know a lot more now than when I first made the film, and maybe I can articulate it a little better and faster. Next, I'm going to be meeting with a JFK researcher, James DiEugenio, who has written an extensive amount on JFK. Some things we agree on, some things we don't, but that's going to be a stellar interview. I'm meeting him at his house, and I'm meeting David Cole, which we'll probably talk about revisionist history and some other things. I may grill him on 9/11 and some of the things he wrote in his book that irked me quite a bit. So that's going to be a lively, spirited discussion. I like David. Spirited may have a more than one meaning with spirits, but that's all good. Three different huge topics, so I have a lot of studying to do, talking with experts on several of them and explaining the whole of 9/11 and JFK is a headache enough without now getting into World War II history as well. But I'm good, and I'm also hoping and looking forward to meeting people in the Liberty Movement, people in the Ron Paul Movement, a lot of libertarians and others, anti-war folks in the Los Angeles area. I will bring a limited number of books that I will sign. If you have a book, I will sign it. I'd love to meet everyone, and I will be there October 10th at the LAX airport around 6 or 7, coming from China. Actually, I have to go to China first. Long story, doesn't matter. But if it's on time, I hope to see you there. Peace.